is the End User, episode 158 for Tuesday, January 14th, Google's Nest. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr.
We're on the tail end of CES here, and I think we are going back to our regular show format. And we've got a lot of good stuff here. You know, we can kind of look back on all of the revelations of CES and, you know, make our picks of the best.
Yeah, it was sort of just beginning, so we didn't have a handle on all of the really cool stuff. So we just focused on the things that were announced right at the beginning of CES. Now we've had a chance to go through the news feeds and find some cool stuff and give you the best of them. But first, we have some feedback from last week's show.
So, yes, we have some feedback. It was in an email form from the Contact Us form over there at thedigitalmediazone.com, and it is from Ron Zimmerman, and he's talking about the French fries that we talked about last week. And
right. These researchers decided to calculate, instead of what kind of oil to use or what kind of potatoes to use or how thin to cut them, they figured what kind of gravity should they use when frying French fries to make them better. And they came up with something on the orders of 3 times Earth gravity.
Right. And so Ron Zimmerman wrote in and he said, I've got a solution for your best French fries conundrum. You don't need to go to Jupiter. Since I was a fighter pilot for 21 years, and yes, engaged afterburners innumerable times,
yes,
I felt the effect of up to 9 Gs, or 9 times the normal force of gravity, while still in the Earth's atmosphere. In fact, I have felt it on the ground. The Air Force has a centrifuge to teach pilots how to withstand Gs, and I'm sure they could set it to maintain 3 Gs. You could just put a boiling pot of oil in the centrifuge with the pilot and a bunch of potatoes and spin them up. He could fry the potatoes, and you'd be able to test the theory, and they would still be hot and crisp when they came out. Of course, so might he.
Yeah, that's what I would be worried about. But you're absolutely right. You could probably rig up some sort of device within the centrifuge that would safely fry the fries and not the cook.
And can we just stop and for a minute? And I love the fact that we can put something random out on the internet, like this podcast, and that will solicit an email from a former fighter pilot. That is, in fact, amazing to me. So,
yeah, it's really incredible. Thank you so much, Ron, for writing in with that. That's made our week, I think.
Definitely made my week. That might be comment of the year, although there's a long year of comments left to go.
Definitely the best comment of the year.
So thank you, Mr. Ron, and let's get into our top news. And leading off the show here, we've got a pretty big story coming out of Google. They're planning to acquire Nest, the maker of the smart thermostat. And the deal is supposedly going to be around $3.2 billion. So that's 3.2 Instagrams. I think Nest is worth 3.2 Instagrams,
yeah, it's,
don't you think?
It's not supposedly. It's $3.2 billion in cash direct from the mouth of Google.
Wow. Yeah, so that's quite a bit of cash considering how young a company Nest is.
Yeah, but they've had a big impact. And this is a little bit surprising, but Google has been looking a lot into robotics and home automation. And I think this makes sense, maybe not in and of itself. It's too soon to say, but it makes sense along with their recent purchase history.
Yeah, I think
it was probably suggested to them by Amazon.
You remember?
We noticed that you just bought Boston Dynamics. Would you like to acquire Nest?
Yeah, that was just suggested to them, right?
Right.
So the deal hasn't closed quite yet. They're hoping to figure it out within the next few months. Quote there in Ars Technica, but I remember 2 years ago, Google was going to supposedly enter the home automation game, and then it just kind of never happened. I guess maybe they're finally getting around to it. I've been extremely disappointed with them not getting into the home automation game, and this gives me a little encouragement that we're going to start to see some of the stuff that they've been working on.
Yeah, hopefully. I assume they have something on the back burner that they can bring towards Nest, and I'm sure it will definitely accelerate Nest's product timeline.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's a they're a company with a lot of resources now that Nest can take advantage of, and you know it'll probably take a while for them to really learn how to take advantage of that. But definitely, they can have the breadth to provide some more products, perhaps. So here's a little thing to think about. Now I know that on the press release from Nest about this, they said that their privacy policy is in fact not changing. And that the data for Nest is going to be the same as it ever was. But are we at a place with Google where we might be a little distrustful of them having this type of data?
I certainly would be, because the way Google does this with all of its products and acquisitions is they'll start by saying, all right, we're not going to use the data for anything. We'll still keep the same privacy policy, but let's quantify it. Let's build it into an algorithm. Let's try to understand it. And then they'll take that algorithm and they'll tweak it. And they say, how can this algorithm help the consumer? And then they'll say, how can we make money off of this algorithm? That's sort of the path that they've been taking with almost all of their products over the past 10 years. And the products that don't fit into that pipeline eventually get axed.
So I'm just waiting for Google Plus to roll out on the Nest. What do you think?
Well, that would be terrifying.
That would definitely be terrifying. It's not within the kind of Nest ethos that they've built up. You know, they want to do one thing and do it very, very well. So probably not. But it will be interesting to see what Google is going to do with home automation. Clearly, they're starting to make some moves, and it'll be interesting to see what actually happens with this. And I would love if they kind of left Nest alone and just gave them the resources to build out a few more more traditional home automation products and give it the kind of design and user experience thoughtfulness that they have had in the first place. And I think that would be a huge win, but I am a little distrustful of Google, you know, sticking their fingers in there and screwing things up. I hope that doesn't actually happen. I would love to see them just kind of let Nest be a business and let Nest make profits for them instead of trying to modify them. So I don't know. We'll kind of have to wait and see what happens with that. But for now, Nest is basically the same old company that it was. And like I said, their privacy policy remains the same. And basically nothing has changed until Google can kind of figure out how to integrate some stuff. So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, I think the Nest's planned products will stay pretty constant for the next few years. But I would not be surprised if we saw maybe some sort of public safety feature rolling out on top of the Nest smoke detectors that links them together and creates sort of an Internet of Things for fire safety.
Yeah, there will be more to come. And like you said, I think whatever was on their roadmap will probably just not change at all. So, yeah, they've only got two products. They're very minimal for the moment. So it'll be exciting to see them branch out.
All right, well, TiVo is branching out. They are adding some new features to their Romeo service. Remember that allowed existing TiVo customers to stream recorded shows to iPads, tablets, phones, whatever they're doing. And now they are adding, I guess, cloud DVR service. And the main feature of this is that if you forget to record something on your home TiVo, you can just download it from the cloud and watch it anyway.
Yeah, or also you could, if you tune into something late, you can just kind of back it on up and just continue to watch it as if you hadn't come into that show late. So that's kind of cool.
I guess the way it works is they will have a cache of 7 days worth of programming for every channel that you pay for through, since TiVo doesn't offer you channels, it's whatever you pay for through your regular service, it'll offer you 7 days of programming through TiVo, even if you didn't record it.
So that's going to be one of the rubs here, is this is not going to be a product that's really available to end users directly from TiVo. It's going to have to go through the cable companies. And it's going to have to be a feature that they provide for you in some way. I'm a little shady on some of the details, but it's going to be through your cable provider. It's not going to be something that TiVo can just magically do for you. But that said, from the end user experience, it kind of doesn't make a difference, right? Because usually you're probably going to get the TiVo from the provider anyway. And I'm sure there are people who don't do that, but that's to get that feature, they have to cooperate with the cable companies in some way. So what's also a little cool is they're planning to have apps that allow you to access the content as well.
Oh boy, more apps on other platforms. That's just what I always wanted.
Do we have app fatigue at this point?
Not me. I actually still think they're pretty exciting. But there are a lot of platforms with apps, and I have just tried to keep the number of platforms with which I interact to a minimum. It's basically just iOS and OS X.
So another cool little tidbit is that they're going to do some integration with Control 4, which is a home control, home automation platform. So that's kind of cool, too. So you'd be able to schedule recordings remotely and that kind of thing, presumably. It's kind of cool to see TiVo is still kicking around. I always kind of write them off, you know, as something that it was like one of the first DVR, you know, it was synonymous with DVR for a very long time. And I feel like they are in decline. And with the advent of Romeo and now with this announcement, I'm starting to think a little bit more of them.
Yeah, the advantage they always had was that they had a better user interface, but their feature parity has been in decline for a very long time. And then just over the last few months, they've really stepped up and gotten ahead of at least the cable and satellite TV industries in terms of feature parity. And this is definitely another step ahead of those industries.
Yeah. So I'm definitely encouraged from what I see. That is fantastic news for TiVo. Good stuff.
Well, I'm really excited about the news that we're getting from MakerBot Industries and Chief Executive Bree Pettis, who had an announcement at CES this year. They make these 3D printers, and they've announced three new ones. Their new flagship model, Replicator, is a little bit cheaper and more featureful. It's $2,900. They're announcing a new mini 3D printer that's only $1,400. This is probably the best value of a 3D printer that you can get as a home consumer at this point. And finally, a slightly more industrial type level, the BigBot Z18 for $6,500.
Cool. Yeah. So they're really starting to come down, aren't they? $1,400 is reachable at this point. These things were just priced out into the sky before, and you had to pay. It was probably about $1,400 if you wanted to solder one together yourself. So as a final product for the Mini there at $1,400, it's really starting to come down to actual human levels of money.
It's starting to get there. I still don't have $1,400 for a Replicator Mini. I would like both of those things.
It's still expensive, but it's now, if they can get below $1,000, I feel like they're really starting to get there. But yeah, at $1,400, it's not going to be something that your typical family is going to get, but it's just the momentum with which they move down the price ladder is encouraging to me.
Right. I think as the library of things that you can build increases and the price decreases, we're very close to the point where actually spending $1,000 to $1,200 on a 3D printer may in the long run be cost effective for some consumers.
And eventually we're going to have a copyright conversation as well around 3D printers. You know, they're still unpopular enough that for the most part it's not that big a deal, but eventually copyright and licensing is going to start to be a sticking issue for them. So we'll kind of see how that works out. Like, what if you print a Lego brick? Is that allowed? Are you allowed to trade Lego bricks? That's a pretty big It's a pretty big trademark or copyright. I'm not sure what they have on Legos, but that's going to be a big conversation as these things actually end up in people's homes over the next, I don't know, 3-4 years or so.
Yeah, and I'm sure those conversations are being had in some circles already, but it is a conversation for another, the end user.
Yeah, and Rennie there in the chat room, and this will be the last bit about the MakerBot, is asking how much the consumable part of it is, in the plastics that you put inside of it, the stuff that actually, you know, the material that gets printed. And, you know, I don't know. I'd have to go out and look at the market. I would assume that it would be the same price that they have been. I'm not sure if that is expensive or not.
From the MakerBot store, a large spool of filament is generally $48 in whatever color you want. I'm not sure how much a large spool gets you, but I would imagine it's more than a pound.
Yeah, that doesn't sound too bad. So it's all about that upfront entry cost and what the thing can do for you down the road. You're right. It's going to be a few years before it is actually a reality in people's homes, but the momentum is in the right direction.
It's a kilogram, generally $48 a kilogram.
All right, well, let's get into some TV news here at the end of the top news. Sony's got an interesting new projector. What's going on here?
Right, so we covered the big flagship TVs from the beginning of the week in our last episode, but what we hadn't heard from yet were the new projector technologies, which are actually taking center stage at CES this year. So Sony is launching a new flagship model, 4K short throw projector that will be available this year. It will probably cost upwards of $30,000 to $40,000, but it doesn't work like a normal projector. It doesn't sit in the back of the room and project across you. It looks like a low, long, high tech bench. And it sits right up against the wall, flush against the wall, and projects a 147-inch 4K display at a very high brightness level for a 4K projector. And it's really just a lovely piece of technology. It's really cool what they've done. And it sits directly against the wall that it projects on. So it's only about a foot tall and maybe a foot and a half to 2 feet deep, and it uses just that space to create almost a 150-inch 4K TV.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. The thing is, just the unit is kind of beautiful looking, too.
It's very beautiful, yeah.
It would fit right in. You wouldn't even think that was a piece of technology sitting there. You'd just think it was, you know, I don't know, part of the floorboard or something.
Right. So that will they promise it will be available on the market this year. They've not announced the price yet, but it is a very cool piece of kit, and it's definitely worth checking out the pictures. And in the second half of this year, if you're ever around a Sony flagship store, that would probably be worth checking out as well. But Philips is also getting into the short throw projector display technology this year. And they're announcing a much cheaper one. It's called the Screenio, and it's more of the size of a normal projector. And in fact, this one has a handle on it for easy portability. And the idea is that it sits on a table about 4 to 24 inches from the wall and can project an image anywhere from 50 to 100 inches across. It's only 720p, but that's generally to be expected for a first-generation product like this. It's a list price of $1,800. But the cooler thing about this is that they have developed a new LED light engine projection bulb. So instead of using a traditional high-power halogen bulb to create the image or to backlight the image, they have a new LED bulb that doesn't need replacement. And actually, Chris, I just had to order a new replacement bulb for my projector, and they're not cheap.
Yeah, they're expensive, aren't they?
they can be pretty expensive. They can be very expensive in some models. Fortunately, I have a model that comes with somewhat cheaper bulbs, but to have a projector that never needs a bulb replacement is a pretty significant cost savings over the life of the device. And also, I'd imagine having LEDs power this projector, it would use a lot less power. My projector uses 250 watts whenever it's on.
Yeah, I'd imagine the bulb has to give out eventually, but the other stuff in the device would give out first, maybe. Would you think that would be about right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know enough about their particular LED light engine technology, and I actually have been trying to find out as much as I could, but they are keeping pretty tight-lipped about it. I do know that they are putting a variant of the same technology in all of their Pico projectors for this year, and it's definitely expected to last the life of the device, so you're right about that.
Now, here's something that piques my interest. We didn't mention it's running Android underneath, and it also has Miracast support. So that's pretty neat.
Yeah, that's right. This is it has Wi-Fi, Bluetooth. It has Android apps. It can do just about anything. That it's practically a full computer in there.
Yeah, yeah. So that's neat. I'm looking forward to see Miracast get included in more places. I feel like 2014 will be the year of Miracast.
Right. The other thing that I like about this projector is that since it's designed to sit on a tabletop near a wall, you don't have to configure the little legs and get the keystoning just right. It generally, as long as it's on a flat surface pointed perpendicular at the wall, you get a perfect square every time, which is not a given with regular projectors.
All right. Well, let's get out of the top news and out of the projector stuff, and let's get into the afterburners. Why don't you give us a start here?
All right. This was a little unexpected to me, but Charter Communications, the cable company, is making a bid to buy Time Warner Cable for $61.3 billion. They've taken it directly to the shareholders of the company. And I don't know if this is going to happen or whether it's going to go through anytime soon, but it would make them, if it goes through, the about the same size cable company as Comcast. And so we'd have something of a duopoly, an oligopoly. I don't know much more about it than that. It's possible that the shareholders will reject the bid, but it's worth mentioning because these are two of the biggest cable companies in the U.S. Offering to combine, and we've already seen some pretty shady content practices from both of these companies. And in other shady practices, Sprint has already canceled their OneUp program after just 4 months. This was the plan that would let people renew their phone or upgrade their phone every year, and it's already gone. You can't sign up for it anymore.
Yeah, that didn't last very long.
Now they have replaced it with a new plan called the Sprint Family Plan, which I thought was a typo the first 10 times I saw it. No, they're actually calling it the Family Plan. I don't know why, but it's just basically shared minutes and data for no reason.
Yeah, that hurts my brain.
I'm sure they have a reason. I'm not particularly interested in it. This is just the afterburner. Let's move on.
So over there at CES, Zotac is showing off a new spherical small form factor PC. It's a prototype at this point, so you know, I'm who knows if it'll ever make it to the market, as with many things CES. So it's a Core i3 with the fourth generation Haswell chip in there, and it seems to be a pretty interesting little computer. You got to check out the link. We've got a link to ourselves, thedigitalmediazone.com. Josh Pollard posted this, and it's a pretty neat-looking little orb computer. Cool stuff.
And that's not the only spherical device coming out of CES. LaCie has also come out with a new hard drive that looks a lot more like a very expensive paperweight. I guess it is. It's plated in polished silver, and it comes in at close to $500 and weighs half a kilogram. So I think it's just a paperweight that's also a hard drive. It's really pretty. I don't know why you would need it, but I figured as long as we were talking about spherical objects at CES, this would be worth a mention.
Yeah, I like the little photo here where you can't really hold it because it's polished silver and you'll get your oil all over it from your hands. So there's a guy holding it and he has to use the little cloth to hold it so that he doesn't get his finger oil all over it. So yeah, real pretty though for what it's worth. So Intel is showing off one of their latest interesting projects. They call it the Edison. And it's a PC on an SD card, which is just completely bonkers. So this is a full by 86 computer on something the size of an SD card. It's truly crazy. So we've got a video and a couple photos in the blog post here. So have a look at the show notes if you want to see this crazy little computer. This is something you could embed in a shirt or something. It's very interesting.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's a very small computer. What's also crazy is that Sony, after launching the PlayStation 4, has yet to launch their long-promised game streaming service, PlayStation Now. But they have finally announced it's coming this summer.
So a company at CES called Airtame is marketing a new HDMI dongle that basically just takes in your computer screen and mirrors it to any HDMI source. So you can basically sling your computer screen around without having to support Miracast like we were talking about earlier. It'll just take it from your computer and sling it over to an arbitrary HDMI port. So that seems like a pretty decent option.
Yeah, I like this idea. This could be one of those things that would help a lot of people get rid of their laptops if they could just stream information from a headless server or desktop onto whatever HDTV they were looking at the time.
So we've got a couple more in the health and fitness kind of category at CES. It's been a very popular category this year, all of the wearable computing. The first is the typically keyboard and mouse company Razer is making a product called the Naboo Smart Band. So this is a device just like the Fitbit Flex is the one that I always think of in this category. And it monitors, what you're doing. I'm sure it has a pedometer and all that kind of thing and has an app. And the Naboo is going to be $99 with a date to be named later. So kind of cool to see them get into that space. So we'll see how that actually pans out when the product is released. So they're saying they're hoping it's going to be by the end of Q1. So another company called Jaybird is releasing a very similar product with a wristband that tracks your health. And I usually think of Jaybird in the context of Bluetooth headphones. So I guess they've got a little bit of experience building some Bluetooth devices. So, again, it's something that snaps onto your wrists and can track you in your sleep and that kind of thing. They're saying that this is going to be available this spring for $199. That's $199. So, this market, I think, is going to be a big one in 2014. It'll be one of the ones to watch. And it's kind of nice to see all the folks throwing their hat in the ring for that.
I definitely agree. We're seeing a lot of people getting into this market and coming up with new and interesting wearable fitness trackers, but I've yet to see anybody that is really standing out in terms of features that separate them from anybody else. Someone should figure out a way to collect more biometrics and display them in a useful way.
Yeah, I think you're right in that. People are throwing their hats in the ring, and it's going to be interesting to see who hits the home run. There's a home run that is yet to have been hit, and I can't wait for that to actually happen. This is going to be some cool tech.
All right, and finally, in our The End User public service announcement this week, it's been reported that users of Google services, Google Plus and Gmail, if you have a Google Plus account, which is pretty much unavoidable at this point, then Google now allows any Google Plus users who find you on Google Plus to be able to send emails directly to your Gmail account.
So there is a way to opt out of that capability, and we'll have a link in the show notes on how exactly to do that.
All right, let's turn off the afterburners.
Yes, let's turn them off. Let's take it easy, get into the end user stories. And we've got a pretty cool one. I think this is my favorite thing that I've seen at CES thus far. And this is from the company we mentioned early with the wearable tech called Razer. And it's called Project Christine. So this is clearly still in some prototyping phase. I'm not sure they have a date or price or anything like that. But they're just showing off the technology, and that's what CES is there for. And you really have to go into the show notes and look at the pictures of this thing. It is completely insane looking.
Yeah, it does not look at all like a desktop PC, but in a very new and unique way. Apple redesigned their Mac Pro. They used to have this big clunky desktop that was known for being modular and easily swappable amongst compatible components, and they've done away with that in favor of a much smaller form factor. But Razer here has created something completely new and much more swappable. But I bet you these parts and components will be pretty expensive if they ever come to market.
Yeah, these things look super premium. I can't imagine this device would be cheap in any sense of the word. I'm sure they'll be quite expensive, but the general idea of it is that you have this kind of tower that you can just slide components into, and not in a sense that, like with a normal desktop PC where you can slide components into the slots. I mean, this is an external interface designed to be pluggable with external devices. There basically is no internal part of this computer, or at least this kind of tech demo that is made for CES. And it just looks really cool. And I'm thinking, this piggybacks on the Intel NUC idea, the NUC. Remember we talked about that a while back?
Yeah.
Where you can just kind of, if you need another processor, you just drop in another processor module. Or, if you want another hard drive, you just kind of drop in a new drive. And I think for a certain class of users, it's definitely a good idea. And this is really cool.
This is definitely the prettiest implementation of that concept that I've seen. I would love to see how they designed it and put it together. But alas, we may never.
Yeah, we may never. This is what CES is for. It's for showing off some technology demo of some sort. And this is definitely one of those things. It's out there. And yeah, we won't see it in the market soon, if at all.
All right, so another technology demo that is completely blew our minds from CES this week is a Nikon technology that uses 64 Nikon cameras in a motion capture array that takes a high-resolution live 3D image of your body and can insert it into a video game in real time.
Yeah, and it looks quite interesting. If you require 64 of these cameras, you can see in the picture here in the blog post that that is a whole ton of cameras. So if you require 64 cameras, presumably they will sell a lot of cameras for anybody that wants to achieve such a thing. But yeah, the technology here looks pretty cool. You have to go look at the picture of the 3D model of the person. And this stuff is actually happening. It's pretty neat.
Yeah, it's amazing. Just a few years ago, you had many hundreds of thousands of dollars more equipment just to be able to capture a person's face, and then to render that would take hours, if not days. And now they can do it with just a couple of off-the-shelf cameras. More than a couple, but still, it's amazing how far this particular technology has come.
You think of the way they would motion capture athletes in the past, and granted that's a little bit of a different formula, but it's starting to be that with a ton of cameras, it's feasible that that could happen at home. It's still going to be expensive, and it's not going to be like a little weekend project or anything, but if you wanted to do that in a home setting, it's not completely out of this universe anymore like it used to be.
Yeah, and I'm sure just like 3D printing, it will get cheaper and cheaper. So at some point in the near future, we're going to have cheap 3D capture and printing at home.
Uh-oh.
Like, then you've really got a copyright problem.
Yeah, yeah. It's going to be interesting, the conversations about the law behind these things. It's going to be an interesting conversation.
All right, in perhaps our strangest CES story and probably our last, there is a new product on display. Is expected to be sold this year, and it is from Sleep Number, the mattress company.
What?
They have taken one of their flagship mattresses and loaded up with all the tech that they could find based on monitoring technology from BAM Labs that has been doing sleep monitoring research for some time now. So it's called the Sleep Number X12, and it starts with your basic Sleep Number dual air adjustable mattress system that they offer and make all of their money on. And then they added things like heart and breathing rate sensors.
Cool.
For one or two different people. And they come up with an iOS app that can add it in. And then they added some extra features like a snore alert button where if your partner's snoring and you wake up, you press the button and it raises that person's head a little bit so that they are more likely to stop snoring. And then they've added voice activation and a night light system into the bottom of the bed, which is motion activated for when you get up in the middle of the night.
And you thought beds were old technology. This is some pretty cool stuff.
Hey, Chris, beds were old technology until now. This is pretty crazy, and I don't know about spending $8,000 on a mattress, but they're saying that these technologies will eventually come down in price, you know, towards their regular $5,000 mattresses.
Yeah, see, we have this middle period where I think you wear the armband or whatever to capture your physical activity during the day, and wouldn't it be cool if it just kind of was embedded in your bed? And was embedded in your place of living and was embedded in all the various places. And instead of having to wear something, that your environment just kind of collects this metadata about you. Wouldn't that be kind of neat?
It would be, yeah. I mean, at night when you're sleeping, that's the one time when all of these wearable fitness monitors or even your phone can't really collect all that much data about you. So to have that built into the bed, it makes a lot of sense. But still very early in these days of it. I have never seen a bed with this kind of tech built into it before, but it's interesting, and it's the future, and that's why it's worth mentioning.
And is this your green tech story? I guess we can get out of our regular The End User stories here and get into green tech. What do we got?
My green tech story this week is... it is a solar-powered refrigerator, basically. I mean, really, it's a cooler with solar panels on it, just your regular beverage cooler. But a man named Ryan McGann has designed a system, a self-contained solar cooling unit built into a regular cooler.
Yeah, so you're using the heat of the sun to produce some electricity that eventually cools the stuff inside of the cooler. That's kind of neat.
Yeah, exactly. And it has just about all the same space as a regular cooler. There's not a whole lot of extra weight or space being taken up by the technologies. And whenever you need cold beverages on the go, you can now do so more sustainably.
Yeah, there's a bunch of... there's a whole subcategory of solar cooling, where the point of the whatever solar technology you're using is to just provide cooling for something. So you're basically taking away the cooling cost during the summer. And I've even seen some passive solar cooling stuff that's really cool. You know, you design air ducts in such a way that cool air happens to flow through them. And there's some really neat stuff around that, and here's one pretty good consumer application. So cool.
Yeah, I thought it was cool too.
All right. Well, from green tech to our tip of the week, if you do have a sleep number bed that is collecting all kinds of data about you and you would like to remain anonymous on the internet with that kind of personal data, how would you do that?
Well, a great way to start would be with the anonymous distributed relay network called Tor. It's open source and it's generally free and community supported and is considered to be a pretty secure way to use the internet if you're using it correctly. But it's pretty complicated, and if you don't use it correctly, then your anonymity is negated. So Lifehacker this week has written up a succinct little how-to on the best practices for using Tor in order to stay anonymous, if that is your goal.
Yeah, it's an interesting technology. It's kind of counterintuitive how it works. But yeah, you're basically providing a method for which an end user can they basically bounce the traffic around enough and encrypt it every step of the way, and eventually when your traffic comes out the other end, there's no way to tell where the traffic originated from. So you know where it's coming from, but you don't know where it originated from. So it provides some anonymity. And to bounce the traffic around all of the layers of the onion, as it were, it does cost you some performance, so it can be a little slow. But yeah, if you are looking to protect yourself, protect your identity from big advertising companies and people like that, and then Tor is definitely a good way to do that.
Right. So since I've been thinking about privacy and also taking control of my own information and maybe running some servers, which is optional with Tor. You don't necessarily have to run your own server in order to take advantage of it, but it's something that they do look for and solicit.
Yeah, in fact,
just in order to increase the redundancy in their network and speed things up, since you do take so much of a speed hit every time you use it.
Yeah, and in fact, it can be kind of dangerous to run a Tor exit node server. I know we've talked about it on the podcast before, but you're basically providing a pipe for other people to do whatever they want, and you're the identity that gets tied back to it instead of the actual originating identity. And of course, you aren't actually doing the things that are coming out of that server from an anonymous user across the internet. But as such, since you're trusting anonymous people out there, then you're put out a little bit. You know, it can be a little bit legally gray to run one of these things. But a lot of people around the world do it, and I think we're better off having this tool than not having this tool.
Right. Well, Lifehacker, or at least one of the comments, suggests avoiding becoming an exit node server. You can just be a relay, and you just
right.
The server becomes a spot where it's bounced from one relay to another. Exit nodes are a pretty advanced thing, and you would probably have to clear that with your ISP first.
Yeah, you'd probably want to do a lot more than that to make sure that it was okay for you to be doing that. But definitely a very cool tool, and one that even if you don't use it, you should at least be aware that it is out there. And, you know, as an option to kind of protect yourself from various situations. All right, well, let's get into our app pick of the week, and you have a pretty good one for us. What's going on here?
I do. I felt guilty that all of my app picks last week were my apps and tips were Mac-centric, so here's a Windows one for our Windows users, and this one is called Task Space. If you didn't know about it, it's a pretty simple function, but it is able to group multiple applications into one window. And then it can also consolidate those tabs in your taskbar.
Yeah, this is neat. So it you get one like scratch space, like one desktop that you can put multiple windows in. And then I guess you can have multiple of these things. So you almost get this kind of like virtual desktops kind of thing. So
yeah, I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I'm not sure. I've got two big old monitors sitting in front of me. Maybe I should try this out on my laptop.
Yeah, I was thinking it would be most useful for people running Windows 7 or 8 on laptops with relatively small screens or with large text sizes.
Yeah, so cool one. So, all right, so I think we're done for our CES coverage of the year. We have seen some pretty cool things. I think maybe we'll leave with just an overall feeling. What do you think about how CES this year went? I think it was more boring than years past.
Yeah, I think there weren't too many technologies that made us say, wow, in a way that was actually going to matter, things that we were going to buy this year. But, you know, I didn't end up buying many things that came out of CES last year either. So I don't know. I'd say it's about the same. If anything, maybe this one is a little bit better.
Yeah, I feel like there's just mostly a technology demo of stuff that we have already seen. You know, there wasn't anything that was insanely new. You know, there's a bunch of new products, but we didn't see like a new approach to many things. You know, we got
super high tech beds. We've never seen that before. Well,
okay, that's true.
As far as I can remember, ultra short throw 4K projectors. You know, I think that's a really big one, and that's an actual product that's coming this year. We saw some interesting things, some announcements that we've been waiting for a long time, Sony's PlayStation Now. And Intel's announced, a whole computer the size of an SD card.
Your fingernail.
There are things coming. It's just no one understands what to make of them yet.
Yeah, I think that's true.
So that's why it feels underwhelming. It feels underwhelming because we don't understand what we're looking at. But if you go back in a year, I think a lot of these technologies are going to become very important.
Yeah, I do wonder, and I kind of said it before, but I bet you this, I see 4K and that's fine. It's fine and expected, but I wonder if the wearables are going to take off, and I wonder if home automation is going to take off, and I wonder if they're going to take off together, and we're going to look back on this CES and say, that was the time that we first got a look at some of this stuff. And, you know, what happens in the future when we get that kind of iPhone moment of home automation and wearables, if we look back here and say, okay, that's when that started, even though they didn't have it quite right.
They may track it back to this, but I think it will... It'll all come together at some point, and nobody will be able to put their finger on when it first started.
Yeah, probably true. Probably true. All right, well, let's get out of here for this week. Taylor, if somebody wanted to contact you on the internet at large, perhaps via a paper airplane drone, how would they do that?
Well, if they had a paper airplane drone, I doubt anything could stop them from achieving what they wanted. But the easier way, probably the more fuel-efficient way, would just be to send me an electronic message, either at taylor@thedigitalmediazone.com or on Twitter at taylorphone.
Cool. And if you want to get at me, I am chris@thedigitalmediazone.com, or you can get me at Chris Hale Barnes over there on the Twitters. So that'll do it for our CES coverage this year. So thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. And, of course, you can find more information, including the show notes, over there at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's THENDUSR. The Digital Media Zone has a few other podcasts. You can have a listen to Entertainment 2.0 that had extensive CES coverage the last 2 weeks. Scene in HD, the movie podcast, and Home On. You can also send us some feedback. Our email together is theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com, or you can also use the contact form like Ron Zimmerman did. You can also tweet at us together. We're at theenduser. You can join us in the chat room as we record the show live every Monday night at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Moth.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.